Well, welcome everybody. Thank you so much for joining me on this live chat seminar. My name is Sue Larkey and my aim in the next 45 minutes is to give you some ideas and insights about autism spectrum disorders. Today, we're not doing a handout as I'm interviewing Jo Atkins, who is going to share her experiences of having a child with autism. I am so pleased that Jo has agreed to be sharing with you, as I always personally find Jo an amazing parent who is always willing to try new ideas and have a go. And I think most importantly, ask questions and constantly wonder what else she can be doing, which I think is often the exhausting part, but what I really admire about Jo. I first met Jo a number of years ago at a conference in New Zealand. Since then, we've written two books together, Practical Communication Programs and Tips for Toileting. These two books have helped hundreds of parents and professionals, and we both regularly get emails from families and schools saying they'd tried everything and then found our books and what a difference they've made. And for both Jo and myself, I think this just makes us so happy to hear where kids have got out of nappies or children who are struggling with communication have been able to try some of our strategies and it makes a difference. After the call, we'll both be on Facebook to take your questions and for people to discuss key points together. We're doing this during the day because we're hoping that families would be available to listen in. But if you are listening to the recording, feel free anyway to post your questions on Facebook when you get a chance to listen to this recording. If you haven't already, please friend me on Facebook because if you want to engage in the conversation, you do need to be a friend. And it's just search for Sue Larkey, S-U-E-L-A-R-K-E-Y, and you'll see Sue Larkey Sydney. I'm hoping today this live chat is another way we can help support you and the children you know. So welcome, Jo.
Hi, Sue.
Can you tell us a little bit about Joshua?
Well, Joshua's my eldest child and he's 10 years old, so he's year six at primary school. He was diagnosed with classic autism when he was just two, although we first noticed signs that his development wasn't on track when he was about 15 months old. At that time, there was no speech, no attempts at communication. There was no copying, no waving bye-bye or clapping hands, all those sort of things that little kids do around about that age. But prior to that, he was just like any other baby. And in fact, I called him my angel baby because he did all the right things at all the right time. He was just a great kid. He's nonverbal, and I think looking at him now, you would all see quite a profoundly autistic child. But underneath his autism, he's actually a very bright and loving child, and he does have thoughts and emotions that are way beyond his years. He's currently mainstreamed at our local primary school in Napier, New Zealand, where he is fully supported by a full-time teacher aide. And he is now above age expectation in literacy and maths, and he's a very valued member of his class and his school.
Oh, thanks, Jo. Now, Jo, can we just go back to when Joshua was originally diagnosed? What is a parent's reaction when they realise their child has autism?
Well, I think we all react differently, but I think it's important to realise that we do go through a grieving process. So it's not like losing a child, but you do lose the life that you thought you were going to have for you and for your child. And I clearly remember the first time I took him to our GP and she mentioned autism and I was quite taken back by that. But we had a big chat about it and then as I left her room that day, she hugged me and she said, just remember, he is still the same little boy you loved when you walked into this room today.
Oh, how beautiful is that. What a fantastic GP. And I think that's a really good reminder for lots of us and maybe something we can all take on. I know as a teacher we can make a huge difference to the way we teach kids with ASD once they have a diagnosis. And for many teachers listening, it's so hard to know how to approach parents and whether we should be labelling their kids. But as a parent, do you think that the diagnosis has been important?
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually one of my passions. Kids are a lot more intuitive than adults. Give them credit for, and they know that there's something different about these kids that are on the spectrum, whether or not they have a diagnosis. And I think that the ASD kids start to realise that they're a little bit different around about their, 8 or 9 years of age. And, let's face it, so that's when all the bullying sort of starts. peer groups start to form and ASD kids start to find themselves sort of on the outside on the peripheral. I think school starts to get harder for them. They start to struggle with the work, and then they generally start hating school. So a diagnosis not only gives them a better understanding about who they are, but I think it gives the rest of us reasons for their behaviour, and then we've got a big whole lot of strategies to be able to help them and then to make a difference. So I actually encourage all teachers to actually start that discussion with parents when they believe a child in their class might be on the spectrum, even if it's just to rule it out. You know, these kids really stand out, but often teachers don't do anything about it for one reason or another. You know, like perhaps there's nothing on their file from previous years, or mum or dad don't seem to have any issues. But I think, you know, often mums see their kids in a very different way than others do, and they're not really looking for things to be wrong. So sometimes I think kids also have great structure and routines at home, and you know, they can be very different kids than what they are at school when they're put into situations where they have to socialise and they have to learn. So teachers just carry on keeping their thoughts to themselves, think this child's a bit odd, tries to survive the year, and then ships them off to the next teacher. And I'd like to encourage all teachers not to be that type of teacher. Start the discussions, do the referrals, and try to make a difference in this child's learning. I think by not diagnosing, we're depriving these people of being who they are, and I think we really do need to stop looking at it as a label and embrace the differences so we can embrace them.
Absolutely, and I think you and I both love that saying of Tony Atwood's, that without a diagnosis, the children and parents are judged, and with a diagnosis, they can be supported. But I'd like to add into that, that often teachers are judged as not managing a child very well or not helping a child learn, and are judged as they're teaching because of the child's behaviour or things other teachers see. But with the diagnosis, then teachers aren't judged too. If a child has a diagnosis, then we can put in place the right supports, whether it be school, home and so forth. But I think you and I both know that that diagnostic process is a minefield and often quite exhausting for families and for teachers, like teachers who send kids off for diagnosis and don't come back with one, or parents who go to one person who says, oh, they're fine, and then they might get a referral to someone else and get a completely different opinion. So, look, I couldn't agree more about the importance of getting a diagnosis, and it really not about being labelling, about putting in place the right supports. Anyway, back to you, sorry. What's the hardest thing about having a child on the spectrum?
It's different for every parent and every child, I think. But for me personally, firstly, it's the lack of sleep. And then secondly, not being able to do normal everyday things that other families just simply take for granted. I've got two other boys, and there's so much more that we'd love to be able to do with them as a family, but we just can't. Even simple things like Saturday morning rugby is difficult for us because Joshua doesn't cope down at the rugby fields. And I usually find myself, you know, off to the side on a playground or something with him, trying to keep him amused while we're down at rugby rather than actually watching the game. So, and often we might have the two boys playing at different, you know, fields on the other side of town at the same time. So we really do have to rely heavily on others to help us out there.
Absolutely. Now, Jo, let's go back to that sleep, because I know there'll be a lot of people listening to this who have kids who don't sleep much. And I know, having known you for a number of years, it's an ongoing thing for you and for Joshua. So is he one of these kids who just doesn't sleep much?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yep. He's great at going to bed and he's great at getting himself off to sleep, but he really just does not need a huge amount of sleep, which is quite ironic because I'm one of those people that do. Sometimes my day can start as early as 4 a.m. Sometimes it's even earlier, because what happens is when he's awake, he expects me to be awake with him.
Yeah, and I guess the biggest question I have to ask, how do you cope with that lack of sleep, Jo? Because I remember having babies and I am not good with broken or lack of sleep. So what do you do about that?
Well, most people who know me know I don't always cope with it. And I'm pretty well known amongst family and friends for falling asleep when I'm out at night. Not good look, but never mind. I think sleep deprivation is really tough on parents. And if we're not getting enough sleep, then it makes our parenting role with our kids so much harder. So I've got a number of strategies I use at various times. One of them, which I don't like to use a lot, is sleep medication for Joshua. So if he wakes too early and I find that I need some more sleep, I give him a fast-acting short-term sleeping pill and sort of send him back to sleep just a few more hours, just when we both, I think, really need it. But I use a lot of social stories and rewards for not waking me up. And one of my favourite strategies is actually to send him to my mother's or to his teacher aid for the night, just so I can have a sleep in the next day and get revived.
Absolutely. And I think that's a totally realistic strategy. Can I just ask you there, Jo, because I think a lot of families feel really guilty when they use respite or send their kids off. Have you been through that sort of, I should be coping better?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I definitely do. You do have that guilt. But I was with Tony Atwood last week and he was talking about how, you know, mums want to retire. And I think that's so true because we do get burnt out. And I think sometimes we need that respite. I think it's really important. And it's not just for you. I think it's also for your other kids in the family and also for the child. Like, I think Joshua needs a break from me every now and then. And I think it's good for everybody.
I agree. And I think many families I know, actually, after they've done it a few times, they start to realise the benefits for the other children and even for you and Dean to have some time without Joshua around, you know, just the impact on the whole family, on your marriage and the other kids. And also, I also get the impression that your mum spoils Joshua while he's there anyway, so it's not like he's missing out on anything at home with you guys. Is that right? Does he
get a good time
when he goes away?
Totally agree.
Okay. Look, because sleep's such a big issue, I'd love, what's your biggest tip to other families who have sleep issues?
Well, I think it was probably Wendy Lawson who's really changed my thinking on sleep. So she told me that she doesn't need much sleep and she had a son on the spectrum and he didn't need a lot of sleep when he was younger either. And I've been with her when she's had absolutely no sleep whatsoever. And the next day she stood up in front of 100 people and delivered an amazing seminar. So I think the biggest bit of advice is just to accept that your child doesn't need the same amount of sleep as most of us do. Once I accepted that, I changed my strategy. So instead of trying to make the focus getting Joshua back to sleep, my focus became keeping him quiet so the rest of us could get the sleep that we need. So I redefined his bedtime rules. I made sure that, you know, he knew it was okay for him not to be sleeping all night, but that he found quiet things to do in his room or he quietly got up and entertained himself. And when I first did that, for about 6 months there, he did that perfectly. And I found myself sleeping into about 7 o'clock and then he'd finally come and wake me up. And but, you know, now he's back to waking at 4 o'clock, but daylight savings is only another month away, and I know when that comes around, I'll get another hour again. So, yeah, I just think the best thing is to accept it.
Yeah, and Jo, I think what you've pointed out there is which something I talk about all the time, that strategies wear out. And, you know, it sounds like that worked for a while and you got your 7 a.m.s and then, you know, things stop working for a while and hopefully you'll go back to that. And sometimes things change for a while and we have to go back to it. But, look, just that Wendy Lawson, what you've said there, I've also seen Wendy after no sleep, and it amazes me how on the ball she can be with absolutely no sleep, yet the rest of us would find that very, very difficult. But I've also noticed with Wendy, it doesn't seem to have a compound effect, where and some of the kids I know, that even though they've missed a night's sleep, it's not like they'll ever catch up on that sleep. It's not like they then have a 12-hour sleep the next night. Have you noticed that with Joshua too?
Yeah, I agree with that. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, let's move away from sleep because I think we could spend our whole 45 minutes talking about sleep. But I'm aware that some people out there actually, their kids sleep really well. But for teachers listening, and teacher assistants, I just want you to remember that when Jo turns up at school with Joshua in the morning, she's often done a 5-hour shift with, or not a shift, that sounds really bad, but you've already had a 5-hour day before Joshua gets to school. And sometimes when parents drop off their kids in the morning, they really just want to get home and have a cup of coffee. And it's not that they're dropping and leaving. They really have had a restless night's sleep or a long night, and they need that respite during the day and a bit of a break for them. So, I think often it's something we don't talk about. We don't ask parents about the sleep, but I think you'd find that many, many parents are sleep deprived, and that affects everyone in different ways. But let's move on to communication, Jo, because I think that's something of major interest to many people listening today. So communication with Joshua has always been a major focus for you as long as I've known you. Can you tell us a little bit about Joshua's communication?
Yeah, well, communication has definitely been our number one priority right from the early years when he was first diagnosed. We did an ABA program until he was about six, and I think this really laid the foundations for all of his learning, and communication was always a major focus of his ABA program. So we introduced a picture exchange system very early on, and we've always made literacy key element to his program, and that included teaching him to type and use a computer at a very young age. The turning point in Joshua's communication came when he was about seven, and I always said that if he wasn't talking at six, I was hopping on a plane and taking him to see someone who could actually physically teach him. And literally, that's what I did. I found this amazing speech pathologist in Brisbane, and I took him over to see her. And she basically opened up a box of treasure for us and the world of communication for him. So at that stage, there were no signs that he could read or write, and he appeared not to understand a lot of what we were saying. And he'd even been assessed 6 months earlier by a clinical psychologist who put him in the intellectually impaired range. And boy, were we all wrong. By eight, he was fully accessing the mainstream class curriculum. He's in the top groups for reading, writing and maths. And he still can't talk, but he types to communicate. We don't give up on speech, and I don't think we ever will, because he's currently showing, you know, a bit of progress using a speech program called Prompt. But talking's his main goal in life. So I think as long as that is his goal, then we'll persist with the speech therapy. Now, like, I know a lot of families don't have access to a good speech therapist, or they don't have the funding for them, or ABA programs. So it's one of the reasons why I wrote our practical communication book, because I really wanted to help other kids that were like Joshua. And a lot of the strategies that we've used for Joshua prior to, you know, him being eight are the strategies that you'll find in the book.
Yeah, absolutely, Jo. I think that's why we were both very keen to write the book. And what's good about the book, it's very eclectic. And over the years with Joshua, you've definitely been very eclectic. You've talked about text, you've talked about prompt just then, you've talked about ABA. And so you've used a whole range of strategies over the years. And I think that's what we've tried to put in our book. I actually thought it might be helpful, I'm going to put you on the spot here, that I read out our... In the beginning of our book, we've put down 10 key rules for a successful communication program. I thought I might read out the rules and see if you can tell us how you did some of those. I won't make you do all 10, but I just thought, like, number one, ensure consistency between environments. So when Joshua was little and you were using things like text and visuals, how did you make sure that he used them in a range of environments?
Well, we made two or three sets of all of the visuals that he used. So, and he would have a set for home, a set for therapy, a set for kindergarten. And he took those with him everywhere he went. And if he wanted something, he had to use them to communicate with everybody.
Brilliant. So it sounds not only did he have access to them across the environments, you also made sure people in those environments knew how to use them and made sure he used them to communicate. Because I think that's one of the tricks with very little kids with autism, that often one person will insist the child uses the visuals, and then they go to kindy and the kindy teacher just gives them the puzzle or gives them their drink, and you miss those key opportunities to communicate. So I think that's an excellent example. Now, number two is be eclectic, try lots of different ideas and strategies, which you've already shared in your answer before. Remember not every strategy works for everyone. Now, I know I'm putting you on the spot, but is there anything that you've used with Joshua that just didn't work? Were there any communication strategies you went, didn't work?
I think, you know, a lot of the speech sort of stuff didn't work. You know, like when people hold something and you expect the child to try and make some sort of sound or, you know, copy what you're saying. Like if you want, you know, a bottle and you're holding out the bottle and you're waiting for some sign, but that was never going to happen with him. So we couldn't do that one. A lot of the speech stuff we just couldn't do.
Yeah, and I think like just this week I was talking to a parent whose child has echolalia, and you know I'm sure that a lot of the strategies in autism books that surround echolalia, where children repeat back what you say, which I mean I've worked with many children with echolalia, I can see those strategies would totally not work for Joshua because he doesn't have a way to echo speech back to people. So you would have had to use very different strategies because of the lack of speech. So number four is never assume incompetence. And Joe, I sort of was looking at this before going, it's fascinating because we wrote this book before Joshua was really communicating as much as he does today. And I think it'd be fair to say, you know, Joshua has excelled beyond what either of us could ever have imagined, but you never assumed incompetence. You always believed Joshua had so much more to say and it was just a matter of accessing that. Number five, always model good communication practices. So can you give us an example when Joshua was younger, how you would model for him?
Well, that's putting me on the spot, that one. A lot of the stuff that you do...
Oh, sorry.
It just comes natural. But we always made him use his picture symbols and we would model using that. So, and we would also speak. So if he wanted a biscuit, he would have to use his picture symbols to say, I want a biscuit. And we would model it. And we would also be his voice for him. So he would point to the pictures and we would actually be the verbal voice for him.
Ah, that's a fantastic example. And that's the same with all kids with their communication. It's so important to model that communication and even a child who's echoing back, giving them good models. Number six is make communication functional, and I guess I would just say with that one, Joe, I know we've put lots of examples throughout the book that where people often use visuals that mean nothing to the child. My favourite's where people have a picture of the toilet and the kid's not really interested in communicating about a toilet, but maybe their favourite Toy Story video or they like going in the car, using things that actually mean something to the child, which links nicely to our number seven, which is make communication fun and enjoyable. And I know one of the things with Joshua and lots of the kids I know is that you've just got to make it short and fun, not hours of speech and hours of using visuals. So even today, Joe, does Joshua use typing all the time or are there times where you just, you know, go with where he's at?
No, he doesn't type all the time and he doesn't want to type for certain people. Interestingly, the other day his speech therapist was trying to get him to type and he actually said, I don't want to type with you, don't I have the choice? Or isn't it my right?
Oh, no.
I thought it was quite funny. But interestingly, the other day at school there was an incident where he wanted to do one thing and during his break time, but one of his aides wanted him to do something else. And he won't type with her. He can't communicate with her at that level because she's just a, you know, lunchtime relief aide. And so his main aide was saying to him, you know, you need to have your visual. She gets out his old lanyard and he typed, I'm too old for that now, which I thought was just gorgeous. He thinks he's moved on from his lanyard and his little wee picture symbol. So my strategy around that was to say, well, you know, type out the words, get rid of this picture symbol, if that's what he thinks is the babyish thing, and just have the word, and then he needs to use that to communicate to the other aide.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the really hard parts of parents and teachers and aides is that often these kids, if you've got a good relationship with them, they will type for you or do work for you or use your visuals. But you put them with someone they don't know, like a relief aide or someone else, and often that resistance, it can be so frustrating because you know the child is capable of it. You know they can do it. but they won't do that for everybody. And, you know, that's where having a fantastic relationship with their aides is so important. But I'll come back to that later. Number eight is use rewards and motivators. So what's Joshua's main reward at the moment? What are you using for him?
At the moment it's YouTube and on my iPhone and also on his iPad. So we use that as a reward. At school he uses, he's allowed internet time where he can get onto a couple of other little websites that have video clips on it, because videos and DVDs and YouTube are definitely his special interest. So we use his special interest to reward him.
Absolutely. And, Jo, I think you and I both know it'd be easy to let him be on YouTube all day, every day, but using that as a reward for him doing other things is the vital, where he just doesn't have free access to that without having to do work, which I know is sometimes hard for families and for Joshua, but I do think using that the things they love is so important. Number nine, ensure the child has a communication-enriched environment, which, you've just talked about that, the fact you've got an iPad, computers, the lanyard, so you're still being very eclectic in your use of a range of strategies, not just the typing, and I think that's really important that we use a range of things. And number 10 is be persistent, repeat, repeat, repeat. And over the years, I guess, have there been times that you get a bit bored of the repetition?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yep. You learn to switch off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the truth. I think even teachers and aides out there will say that you just learn to go with the repetition and just switch off a little bit. I think that's so true. Okay, well, thank you for sharing all that about Joe, about his communication. I thought we might also, because the other book we've written together is The Tips for Toileting, and I know we get a lot of emails where people are really struggling with the toileting, and just this week I met at school, I spoke to a teacher at a school, a 12-year-old in nappies. Now, it just breaks my heart to think that a child has been allowed to go to 12 years of age in nappies. And I guess what I think is it just gets harder, that if people leave it till 12, the school and family have got a huge battle to change that routine for that boy now, because he's been in nappies for 12 years. But I know with toileting Joshua, that wasn't a piece of cake. So can you just sort of share a little bit about your Joshua Joe's standoff around toileting?
Yeah. I think I pushed everything else in my life aside and focused solely on the toilet training. So, and he was three. So I think the younger you do it, the easier it is. I wouldn't recommend, especially with a kid like Josh, I wouldn't recommend leaving it too much later than that, because it just gets harder to be so intensive with it. And I think it took Joshua a good 5 days before he learnt the connection between him doing wheeze in the toilet and the reward that he was getting. People often ask me about what reward I used, and I actually moved a TV and a video player into the bathroom. So he would sit on the toilet every half hour for 10 minutes at a time. We stretched that out to an hour as we got to predict his, wee patterns a little bit better. And we fed him lots of, lots of juice and salty foods to get the urine coming. And every time he started weeing in the toilet, we would play the Thomas the Tank Engine video clip. And we used that one because it's short, it's 5 minutes, and he was one of these kids when he was younger that had to, watch all the credits all the way through. So it took about 5 days for him to learn that the connection. And we started to fade the use of the reward too soon. So literally he stopped toileting and went back to accidents and wetting his pants. So the minute we brought in the TV back into the bathroom again, he got up and went straight to the toilet, sat down and done a wee. So, at three, he was intelligent enough to know how to get what he wanted. I don't think I was as persistent with the poos as, probably sounds quite gross talking about this actually, but with the poos.
I'd just written down on my piece of paper, what about the poos? So yeah, we're on the same word there, Jo.
With that, I think I used to put a nappy on him at night time, and he would hold all day long, and he would have his bowel motion at night. And I think he got to about four, and I decided, enough's enough. I don't like seeing him do this anymore. That's it. No more nappy. And so I stopped the nappy, and he held on to his poo for 9 days. And you can just imagine how uncomfortable the poor kid was.
How was his behaviour? Sorry,
it wasn't too bad. I waited one night until you could tell there was no way he was going to be able to hold it any longer, and whipped him into the toilet and had great success. He got a huge reward, and that was it. He was done. Consistently doing poos in the toilet after that. So sometimes it just takes a bit of persistence, a bit of tough love, and the belief in them that they know what they're doing, and you can help them. But hey, the strategies that we used can be seen in our tips for toileting book. So I do encourage anybody that's not toilet trained, their child under, by four or five, to definitely have a look at that book.
Yeah, I'd encourage that too. And there's also just a nice little summary tip sheet, like 10 points to get you started on my free tip sheet. So if people go to www.suelarkey.com, there's the free tip sheet to get you started. And if you have no luck with that, we'd recommend you get the book, because the book has all the visuals and the frequently asked questions. And also, I guess, the strategies both Joe and I have learnt over the years. So, yeah, well, thanks, Joe. And I think for families out there with toileting, I guess Joe said 3 years. Couldn't agree more. Get the earlier the better. Give it a try. And even at three, if you give it a try, a couple of weeks, no luck, you know, you can give yourself, say, 3 months off and then try again. You've got a lot of time on your side. But as soon as the kids start getting to five and beyond, we actually know they lose muscle control because they haven't actually learned to manage those muscles. So the earlier you get in, the less deterioration of the muscles. And so anyway, long story, I agree, Joe, go to the book. So what I'd love to know now, Joe, Joshua's 10 now, so we've talked about his communication when he's younger and getting older and his toileting, but what are your main battles now with Joshua?
Oh, look, it changes from month to month, sometimes even day to day. But I think the best strategy to manage any behaviours is to really understand autism. And you need to understand the underlying reason for the behaviour. I had a really good life experience last week when I had Tony Atwood out, and me and my business partner, Charmaine Brown, were running seminars with Tony around the country amidst the worst polar freeze this country's ever seen this century. They were calling it a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And I'd heard a few days before that the weather forecast wasn't going to be good, and I started to get quite anxious. And I know Tony often says there's a little bit of ASD in all of us, and I certainly found the ASD in me last week. I became very single-focused. Nothing anyone could say could ease the anxiety. I was very grumpy, and I was very short-tempered, couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. And the night before I left, my husband and I went out for dinner to celebrate my birthday. And the next day, my brother says to him, "Ooh, don't think it would have been very good in your house last night." And my husband's like, "Well, why?" And he's like, "When Jo's stressed, she's not a nice person to be around." And my husband replied, "No, she was great. I got rid of the kids for the night and I gave her a glass of wine. And after that, she was fine." So if you look at that as a strategy, what did he do? He changed the environment for me. And secondly, he gave me a relaxant. So it's not that I'd recommend you give an ASD child a glass of wine, but there are other things that you can do to relax them and calm them, like giving them a drink of water. I know you often say, Sue, that drinking from a straw can be very soothing for our kids, and they do need so much more fluid than the rest of us do. So I think it was just a great life experience of, you know, like these kids have that anxiety constantly, and to put ourselves into that position and understand what it's actually like for them, I think you can find strategies that might be able to help them. But anyway, I managed to make it to our destination without any disruptions, but poor Tony and Charmaine were stuck in Wellington Airport for 3 days trying to reach me. And you could just imagine how frustrating that must have been for them. But I said to Charmaine, "Well, how is Tony?" And she's like, "Well, he's so calm and patient. He's been great." But I think, you know, one of our other presenters, Wendy Lawson, if it had been her with us, things would have been completely different, because Wendy's on the spectrum. She requires structure and routines. And while she's away, to touring, she relies heavily on those that are looking after her, and she copes by trusting us. So when she comes out, we give her a visual schedule, we explain all the things that are going to happen, and we're able to notify her of any changes. So you could imagine how hard that would be for someone on the spectrum, seeing us very anxious and stressed and not being able to tell her what's going on because we just literally didn't know ourselves. I remember one time we were actually touring with Wendy and I had to pick her up in the morning. So I said to her, I'll be there at 8:50. And I turned up at 8:45. She wasn't ready. And I put her into a complete spin. And I said to her, it's okay, I'm early, just take your time and do all the things that you need to do. But for her, that was a little comfort because in her eyes, it wasn't okay. And I had lied because I was there at a time that I didn't say I was going to be there. So anyway, that day she proceeded to tell all the people at our seminar that she wasn't sure if she should still be my friend. So the next night, isn't she gorgeous? The next night I told Wendy I'd be there.
I can just see Wendy telling everyone that because you got there 5 minutes early, and that's, you know, this is the thing. Anyway, back to your story. Sorry, go.
Yeah, so the next day I said to her, I will pick you up about 8:45. So she looked at me and gave me one of her cheeky little grins, and she was probably thinking, oh, this is neurotypical, she finally gets it. But anyway, the next morning I come out, I'm standing outside her door, and I checked my watch, and it was only 8:44. So I stood there twiddling my fingers, and I waited one more minute before I knocked on the door, because I figure that, well, Wendy's just far too valuable to lose as a friend. But I think, you know, you can see that just by changing the way we say things, can make a huge difference into the way an ASD person can actually understand what we're saying.
Absolutely. And for me personally, every time I see Wendy, I learn so much from her. And I remember one day at a workshop, I said to everyone, it was time to sit down after morning tea, and I said, can you all sit down, please? And Wendy looked at me, she said, well, maybe they can, but do they want to, Sue? She said, you shouldn't say words like can. And I hadn't realised how often we think by saying can, we mean do it. But for a child with ASD, that's an option. It's a yes or no. And that's where I find Wendy just fantastic. And that story you tell, I also remember when we were in the UK with Wendy that I think we had the hire car was running late or something, and Wendy was pacing up and down and highly anxious. And it was maybe only 2 minutes, but it really changed her anxiety for the rest of the day. And I often have to remind myself of kids with ASD that often when they come to school anxious, it might have been the smallest thing that went wrong in the morning, but what we need to do is give them the time to process that and give them some space or some sensory, or like your husband did the other night, a glass of wine. But we need to give them space, and being in their face can actually escalate that behaviour pretty quickly, which is where I think Wendy just provides the most amazing insights. Out of all the people I know on the spectrum, she seems to really get how we see the world and how we confuse her. Is that what you find?
Oh, yeah, and, you know, you've got a DVD of Wendy, which is, I think, is just great, and I actually recommend that to all parents and teachers, because what she has to say is just a huge insight for us into her world of autism. And she can just give us some simple ideas on how we can truly make a difference. And, you know, even if it is, just by changing a few, you know, a few of the things that we say. But going back to your initial question, Sue, is, you know, what's our biggest battle? Well, I think the biggest battle parents always have is the schooling system. So generally, if school's going great, then life's going great. And I think our kids have a right to a good education, just like all kids. But many schools just don't get it. And I, you know, Joshua is really fortunate to have a local state school, which I believe it's benchmark for mainstream schools trying to accommodate special needs children. And every year there's very careful consideration on which teacher would be the best for him for the following year, and that teacher starts the transition with him early in term four. He has an amazing teacher aide, and she's been with him for a long time, and I just don't know where him, the school, or us would be without her. She's got a brilliant mix of being supportive and caring and understanding, but she's also very firm with him. So she believes in him, and she knows what he can achieve if he puts his mind to it, and she's there to support him with that. So he's got a lot of respect for her and his teachers, and, you know, we all know that happy children are good learners. Now, next year, Joshua's off to a new school. So we here in New Zealand, we go off to intermediate for years 7 and 8. And I was really anxious about that. But this new school, you know, it's 6 months out. They've done transition visits. The school, you know, teachers and teacher aides coming into the school where he is at now, and they're preparing themselves for him. And I just, they're just fully embracing him, and it's just fantastic. And it makes, takes away the anxiety for not only for Joshua, but it also takes away our anxiety. And you know, transition's very hard. So what they can do to help is just great.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, I've known you for a long time, and one thing I know is that you've had changes of principals, you've had changes of teachers, aides. You've always, though, been able to create an incredibly positive relationship with your schools, and I think not all families out there and not all teachers out there would have that same relationship. But I don't know how you bottle that, Joe, or explain it, but is there anything that you can, like, just a couple of tips for parents or teachers who are trying to build that positive relationship? Because I know that Joshua was one of the first kids with autism at his school, but now there's many kids. So you've sort of been a trailblazer at that school. So what, have you got a couple of tips that could help families?
Well, I think it's good to be really honest with them. So, you know, and sharing the diagnosis is really important too, and educating everybody involved. So every year we send our classroom teacher to a Sulaki seminar and anything else that's going on. And we try and take away the barriers. So, like, you know, a teacher aid training is so imperative, but we all know that the child can't be at school if their teacher aid isn't there. So we tend to leave Joshua at home and we look after him just so that his teacher aid is free to go. But the sharing of the diagnosis is really important, and every year that we sit down with the children and we tell them about Joshua, and he's involved in that process as well. So he, you know, writes out some things that he would like the kids to know, and he writes letters to his new teachers to let them know things that are really important to him. And it's just working with the teachers and the school. You know, teachers seem to know, you know, they know about teaching, and I think parents need to understand that, but teachers need to understand that we've got our children for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the difference between a good teacher and a good teacher aide is life-changing for these kids. And so I think it's just really important to keep honest and open lines of communication, and to respect each other's roles in this kid's life, and to work together as a team.
Absolutely. Now, Jo, I cannot believe, after us worrying what we were going to talk about for 45 minutes, our time's nearly up. So, look, you seem to have such a positive attitude, and that's something that I've always, you know, enjoyed talking to you. And that's not to say you don't sometimes go, I've had enough, and I just don't want people to think it's all easy. You have your moments. You say, no, I need a break. But that's also always very positive and so forth. So what helped you get through, Jo?
Oh, well, I have a wonderful husband, and we work together as a team. And we've got an amazing group of friends and a wonderful family. And everyone has embraced Joshua right from the beginning. And it was a huge support to us. They all adore Josh for all his faults and his oddities, and they're always there for me. And, you know, sometimes I can be a bit over the top with his accomplishments. I'm a bit like a first-time parent with their first child, and even at 10, I'm still raving about his milestones. And they listen and they share my excitement. And you know what? When I'm having a hard time, they wipe away my tears and they tell me how amazing I am. My girlfriends take me out, pamper me, and they all acknowledge that because I've got a special needs child, that makes me a parent with special needs. And family and friends help out with my other kids as well, and that allows me time to spend with Joshua. So, you know, boys are typically loud and hypo, and my guy's no exception there. So sometimes Joshua just needs some quiet time, and I've got an amazing brother who lives just down the road, and he's great with my boys, including Joshua. And I remember when he was first diagnosed, and we lived out of, you know, lived away from my family at that time. And my brother sent me an email, and he said, you know, we're all here for you. You're not alone in this. And we certainly don't feel alone. Often my brother will take Joshua out swimming or riding on his bike. And as much as he's doing it for Joshua, he's actually also doing it for me as well. you know, I mentioned before that respite is really important to keep your spirits up when you've got a child on the spectrum, and, you know, particularly as they get older. But really, probably the person who most helps me get through is actually Joshua himself, because he's taught me empathy and tolerance. He's taught me to be selfless and really how to appreciate the small things in life. So I personally think he's enriched my life, and he's certainly made me a better person. And it isn't always easy, but, you know, his accomplishments are really what gets me through the tough times.
Well, just a couple of things on that, Jo. I mean, I think everything you've said there is so true. And one of the things that the reasons that I love being around you is you always do share the what might be small achievements but big achievements for Joshua. And for me, I love hearing the things that he's achieving. And I guess that does make it easy to support people when they tell you the down bits, but they also tell you all the good bits. And I know I've got the video of Joshua saying mum, one of his first words last year, on my iPad, and I often just look at that, and it always just inspires me to see him, and I know the effort that's gone into just that one word. And I know your brother took some great video of him off riding his new bike recently, and I've got that too. And you know, for me, the fact you share those things is one of the things that I find really inspiring, because I do like to hear what's happening for Joshua and what's going on, and for you too. So, yeah, I think that maybe we'll put on Facebook next week so people just share with someone they love one of the things their kids achieved this week, because I think we do often always think what's more with these kids, but it's so important to think, well, what have they done? Well, I know we've gone over time, I hope people don't mind, but I guess one of the things I'd really like you to share, Jo, is I know recently you spoke at a conference, and Joshua wrote that lovely thing that he wanted people to know about him. Have you got that there? Am I putting
you
on the spot there?
He uses this quote quite frequently when he's, you know, having to write about himself and share his autism with other people, and I do think it's just beautiful. He says, "I would love to be free of autism, but this is who I am. I can't change that. I'm a person under the autism. Remember that." And I just think that's just gorgeous. So insightful.
Absolutely. It is so insightful. And he is absolutely a person under the autism. I just want to thank you for sharing with us. And do you have any just last-minute key tips for parenting kids with ASD?
Okay. Key tips. Well, firstly, I think you need to fast-track that grieving process I talked about earlier. You know, parents, the faster you move on past that grieving phase, the faster you can accept that your life is going to be different, and you can embrace it for all the wonderful things that it can be. It is a wonderful journey in the end. Secondly, I think early intervention is a key to long-term success for your child. Thirdly, I think to make their life and yours a success, you really need to understand autism and understand their world. So I do recommend you get educated on autism. And finally, and most importantly, I think never give up on your belief in your child. I think they need you to be strong and to believe in them.
Absolutely. Well, Jo, I can't thank you enough. It's been just so lovely, and I've got so much out of chatting to you, and I'm sure that people listening have got a huge amount out of this as well. So thank you so much for giving up your valuable time to be with me today. I hope everyone has enjoyed the call, and Jo and I look forward to chatting to you on Facebook now. Can I ask that you actually post questions in the public area, is because if people send us personal messages, it's actually quite hard to manage all those personal messages and post it in the public area. I mean, you're welcome to send us messages over the next few days, but just it is nice to have more of a public conversation to start off. Or you can send questions via my website at www.suelarkey.com. And look, we really look forward to hearing from you, and I would encourage all of you to stay listening to a song both Jo and I are finding incredibly inspirational. It's called "The Life That's Chosen Me," and it's by Karen Taylor Good. And I think that this really does sum up what we've been talking about this morning. So thank you. Oh, and this afternoon in New Zealand. So thank you very much.
We had such expectations, we would soon be given birth to the next Chopin, the next Einstein.
The moderator has left the conference.
The greatest child on earth. And we'd be the perfect family. Soon we'd have the perfect kid. We'd never have a challenge or a problem, God forbid. Oh, but life had different plans. So I need for you to understand. Don't desert me. Don't ignore. I need friends now more than I ever did before. But please don't pity me. I'm a parent just like you, it's true. But I have special needs. I need you to notice that my life's different from yours. I need you not to judge me. Don't compare and don't you swore. I love and